Chapter 9. "My dear Sir Joseph," wrote Stephen, "how I wish I had the words to express my admiration at the celerity of your message and at your very particular kindness in sending down to Dorset for as much as the ladies concerned could write while the chaise was turned round. The celerity, of course, owed a great deal to Mr. Bridges' ingenuity, together with his profound knowledge of Andean passes, and to the most uncommon physical powers of his Indian runners, but even more to the network of Republican Masonic lodges that found us here rather than at our southern port. Yet the kindness was yours alone, and I thank you very heartily, enclosing the briefest of all brief replies. Now, as for the actual posture of affairs here in Santiago and the rest of Chile, the varying composition of the juntas, roughly one for each considerable stretch of territory, and their convictions, to say nothing of their desire for power, makes any prediction so tentative in my present state of knowledge that it's scarcely worth writing down. Yet I will say that O'Higgins, the supreme director, appears to be losing popularity, together with San Martin, whereas the Carrera brothers and Martinez de Rosas are certainly increasing theirs. When I've been here a little longer and have spent more time with the invaluable Dr. Jacob, I shall send you a more considered, better informed account of the shifting, almost impenetrable political scene. But for the moment, I should close, if I may, with my sincerest thanks for the increased grant and a few words on our naval affairs. The first of these words is a little discouraging, since it must state that His Catholic Majesty's heavy frigate, renamed O'Higgins, of no less than 50 guns, is now found to have become wholly unserviceable through age and decay, and the Republican ports are very short of all naval stores. On the other hand, Captain Aubrey and Sir David Lindsay have reached a working agreement, and Surprise is now lying off a small port in Chiloé, which is still held by the Royalists, who have a considerable base there as well as two or three of moderate size. But the port in question is a commercial harbour in which a notorious Spanish privateer has taken refuge, a vessel that Surprise means to board and take by night at slack water, so that if the wind should fail, the ebb will bring her out. He is attended by three Republican sloops, which, says he, know nothing of their trade, but are pitifully willing to learn. Each has an experienced R.N. master's mate or senior midshipman to help them. And heaven knows the Republic has a very great and urgent need of sailors who possess at least the rudiments of their calling when the naval force of Peru is considered, with their 32-gun, quite new frigate, others somewhat older but serviceable, several ship sloops and brigs manned by a body of competent professional officers and seamen and commanded in effect by a viceroy perfectly loyal to his king and bitterly resentful of the royalist defeat at Chacabuco. The Peruvian army may be discredited, but this most certainly does not apply to the Peruvian navy. And while the Spaniards still hold the southern base of Valdivia, and those on the important northern island of Chiloé, the new republic's trade, its seaborne trade, is in constant danger, and swarms of privateers, under royalist license or no license at all, take whatever ships they can overtake and overwhelm. Now, until I have the honour of writing more fully, after consultation with Dr. Jacob, I shall just append a provisional list of the juntas of which I have personal knowledge, encode the whole, and end with the utmost gratitude, dear Sir Joseph, your humble, obedient, and most affectionate servant, S. Maturin. Before encoding the whole, however, S. Maturin looked at the two scraps of paper that had come with Blaine's message, one addressed to him, the other for Jack. Unfolding his own, he read with infinite tenderness, "From two very close friends at Woolcombe, with their dearest love, Bridget, and Christine. But hearing someone at the door, he thrust it secretly into his bosom. The sound at the door was, of course, Jacob. Unlike many Orthodox Masons, he had no strong prejudice against these somewhat irregular Republican lodges in Chile, but he did deplore their loquacity. "At least," he said, sitting down heavily and taking snuff, "I did learn that the younger O'Higgins, the one you were so friendly with in Peru, will be here tomorrow." "Ambrosio? Yes, I did like him, and could wish to see him again. A deadly shot, and a not inconsiderable botanist. Would it be sensible to invite him, do you think?" Jacob considered, took more snuff, and said, "It would be noticed, of course, particularly if we went to Antoine's. But I don't think it would do any harm, rather the reverse." "Then I shall invite him. Never was a more permeable frontier. We have a reasonable number of agents there, I believe. Tolerable, tolerable. We could certainly do with more. See if you can find a couple of reasonably intelligent, reasonably truthful men with some nautical experience to keep an eye on the state of naval preparation in Callao. There are rumours of unusual activity. Amos, forgive a personal question, I beg, but do you put crumbled coca leaves into your snuff?" "No. I have more respect for the septum of my nose. I keep to mere tobacco. It's not so good, admittedly, but it revives me after the dreary meetings. And as you see, tapping it, my septum is intact. Long may it remain so. For my part, I prefer to chew or swallow. In moderation, of course. Should you like to cast an eye over my synthesis of your information on the hunters and their political colour?" "Certainly. And I shall encode my piece for Whitehall, and then, with the blessing, we can dine. The day after tomorrow, having seen young O'Higgins, I mean to go down to Valparaiso. Captain Aubrey should be back by then. Will you come?" "I'd rather stay, if you don't mind. Two or three agents will be coming here from Lima." As Stephen rode down on a fine, smooth-paced, dapple-grey mare, he turned a towering shoulder of rock, and there was the ocean before him. An enormous, magnificent sea stretching to the horizon, and beyond the horizon, if his memory served, to China, Crim Tartary, and the countries beyond. But here, close at hand, relatively close at hand, was the dear surprise. Unmistakable with her towering 36-gun frigate's mainmast, and accompanied, which was by no means unusual, by a prize. A moderate ship-rigged privateer, now with drooping ears, and in her turn accompanied by three Republican sloops. These little vessels, though new to the game, knew enough about the ways of the prize court to remove everything of value aboard, whether it was screwed down or not, and even from this distance they could be seen swarming over the side with their prey like a body of ants. At this early stage, when the foreigners, and nothing could have been more foreign in Chile than Jack Aubrey, fair-haired, red-faced, massive, his officers and most of his hands were looked upon as valued, welcome allies, it was a pleasure to walk about Valparaiso with smiles, bows and cheerful cries, "Merry Christmas! Good night!" on every hand. And when he'd confided the mare to a stable that he obviously knew and liked, Stephen walked into the Capricorno with a mild satisfaction, if not complacency, instantly succeeded by open astonishment as he recognised Dobson and his shipmates sitting at a punch bowl, all delighted by his surprise. They made him sit down with a variety of delights. "I had no idea you'd be so far north already," he said. "Oh, the Isaac Newton can be induced to go at an astonishing speed. And having a professional master and his mate who knew her very well on the Lisbon run, we can even sail by night, you know. There's that amiable young man of the schooner, Mr. Reed," said another fellow, interrupting his account of a dicotyledonous plant unknown to science. "Let's be mute and see his amazement." The amazement reached their highest expectations, and they sat William Reed at the top of the table. "Tell me, sir, said Stephen's neighbour in a low voice, nodding towards William's hook. "Does the young gentleman ever feel the effects of electricity? Or static electricity?" "I don't believe so, sir," said Stephen. "But then there's a considerable amount of insulation between the steel and his flesh, you know." A pause, and he went on. "I'm wonderfully ignorant of the whole subject. Is there yet a general theory of electricity? Electricity, what it is?" "Not that I know of. Its effects can be seen and measured. But apart from that, and some pretty wild, unsubstantiated statements, I don't think we yet know the ABC. Though Lancaster may. He's done a great deal of work recently with copper wire in coils. Mr. Lancaster?" "Well, Aubrey," cried Mr. Dobson, "welcome ashore. All we need now is Noah, Neptune and a couple of Tritons." And he called for another bowl of punch. Punch or no, they listened very attentively to Jack's brief play-by-play account of boarding the privateer from the landward side, while Surprise's few mortars, briskly served, pooped up various lights into the seaward sky, varied with flashes and shattering bangs. This really finished the day. After a somewhat rambling and hazy supper, three or four fellows were led up to bed, and the rest sat under the starlit sky, sobering themselves with the iced juice of various fruits. "What was the damage aboard?" asked Stephen, as they walked back to the Mayor's agreeable inn. "Extraordinarily little," said Jack. "Nothing that dear Poll couldn't deal with. Those fellows, those Chiloe privateers, knew nothing about action. They sailed their ship quite well, but as for fighting her... On the other hand, our young fellows really pleased me. Our Chileans, I mean. They handled their craft quite well on the way over, and they boarded her like goodens, cutlass in hand." "Shall you ride back tomorrow? I have two men to see, and then I'm away." "I don't think so. Since I speak no Spanish, I'm not much use in Santiago, now that I've done the civil thing with your help by all the proper authorities. Nah. Down here I can really accomplish something according to our agreement with the Supreme Director. They have good yards, decent craft, up to 100 tons or so, and at this time of year the breezes are reasonably steady and kind, and above all the eager young men learn very quick. Harding and Hewell speak a little Spanish, so do a few of the petty officers and hands, but the great thing is that most of them grasp the idea from goodwill and example. A rolling hitch is not all that simple the first time, but I only had to show Pedro once and he did it again and again, laughing with pleasure and asking my pardon for laughing." "I'm heartily glad to hear what you say, my dear. We may have great need of young men that can tie a hitch. But as for laughter, open audible laughter, I quite agree with your Pedro. There is something curiously offensive about it. Above all, when it's not truly amused, deeply amused. A parcel of excited young women screeching aloud and agitating their persons and limbs is enough to make one retire to a monastery. Our fellows did not present a very elevating spectacle." I did notice some of the Spaniards looking rather grave, and I did regret the last bowl of punch. Yet, on the other hand, ours is an eminently respectable society. The proceedings are known all over the learned world, and the men of the Isaac Newton, however bibulous on occasion, carry recommendations to the government, foreign office and universities of whatever country they visit. I do assure you, Stephen, that our connection with them, with the society as a whole, in its most sober and learned mood, is a singular advantage to us. My dear, I am entirely in agreement with you. No other fellow more. Yet even so, I could wish they would not laugh. Or at the least, if they are truly amused, that they would laugh like men rather than eunuchs. Oh, my dear Jack, he said, pausing at the door, I'd almost forgot a note for you in Sir Joseph's packet. He passed it over, a more substantial letter than his own and written very small. It was some time before Stephen came back to their inn, for he had found the small Catalan colony in Valparaiso dancing their native sardana in the square outside St. Vincent's, and he walked in smiling, the familiar music still running in his head. But the smile was wiped clean away by the sight of Jack, so reduced with sorrow, deeply unhappy, red-eyed and bent. Stephen had often deplored the tendency of the English to display their feelings, their emotional weakness. But now, looking sharply at his friend, he saw something quite out of the common run. And indeed Jack stood up, blew his nose and said, "Forgive me, Stephen. I do beg pardon for this disgraceful exhibition, but Sophie's letter quite bowled me over." He held up the almost transparent pages. "She's so brave and good. Never a harsh word, not a hint of complaint. Even though the girls have been really ill, and Henage Dundas isn't quite pleased with Philip's conduct in Menelaus. She brought the whole place so alive, Stephen, I could see it all. Courtyard, stables, library, tenants, farmland and common. And she said such kind things about Christine and your Bridget. Lord, it quite unmanned me. Strutting about on the other side of the world, leaving everything to them. I had no idea how attached I was." Stephen took his pulse, pulled down his eyelid and said, "It is very, very hard. But in the first place, you're to consider that you still have the best part of a gallon of blood to make up, that the dear west wind will waft us through the strait, and then, which is not improbable, if you accompany the squadron, it will also take us to the Cape. And there, with the liberation of Chile behind you, you may bring Sophie down and any others you choose to a delightful, healthy country, new sights and admirable wine. Sophie dearly loves her glass, God bless her. And as a physician, I do assure you, Jack, that we must sup extremely well on thick beefsteaks with a large amount of Burgundy. I know where Chambertin is to be had, and then a soothing draught to take to bed." The next morning, having fondly visited both men of war, how very much at home he felt in either, having greeted all his old shipmates and they reminding one another of cruel hard times, how the doctor had declined a gravid seal's burden, and having conferred with Paul and Maggie about their cheerful, well-bandaged patients, he rode away. With the dusty town behind him, he struck into the main Santiago road, almost deserted that day. Up and up on the fine pacing mare, and quite soon he reached that stretch of fissured, apparently soilless shoulder of rock, so remarkably studded with the small, extraordinarily spiny cactus locally called the Lion's Cub. It took them an hour and more to round this vast mass and reach the further stretches where the winding road rose and fell through almost barren ground, barren except for some botanical wonders, and, for so bare a countryside, remarkably well populated by birds of prey, ranging from a minute shrike to the inevitable condor. The rise took up at least 9/10 of the way, a steady, inevitable rise, with every now and then a descent so steep that he dismounted and took the bridle. And all the way along this prodigious highway through the mountains, whether he rode or whether he walked, there before him at various distances, sometimes diaphanous, occasionally sharply focused and clear, he saw, not indeed Christine, but various aspects of her. And the miles went by unnoticed until the mare stopped at the usual resting place and turned her mild gaze upon him with a hint of reproof. On the next stretch, they passed through an invisible barrier into a thinner, cooler air, and there were his, not illusions, perceptions might be the better word, of Christine again. Clearer and sharper now, particularly as she moved across a dark wall of rock. A tall, straight, lithe figure, walking easily and well. He remembered with the utmost clarity how, when she was reading or playing music or training her glass on a bird or merely reflecting, she would be entirely apart, remote, self-contained. And then, how she would be wholly with him when he moved or spoke. Two quite strikingly different beings. And the delight in her company, as he delighted even in the memory of it, seemed to him essential happiness, fulfilment. Of course, he was a man, quite markedly so, and he would have liked to know her physically. But that was quite secondary. A very remote stirring compared with gazing at this phantasm, this now remarkably clear and sharply defined phantasm against the rock face. He'd gathered that she was respected but not particularly liked in the colony, where her most uncommon beauty seemed to pass, if not unnoticed, then at least sometimes unadmired. In a crowded gathering, he'd heard a conventionally pretty woman say, "I can't think what they see in her," referring to the group of young and middle-aged men who rarely moved far from where she was standing. In Stephen's long-considered opinion, the most striking thing about her was the change from a perfectly well-bred woman, little given to personalities or colonial chit-chat, reserved but not at all woundingly so, and the remarkable change to warmth and sympathetic exchange with someone she liked. When the change took place, her whole physical attitude changed with it. At no time did she ever hold herself stiffly, but now there was a suppleness in her whole stance. And Stephen, who had watched her more closely than he'd watched the rarest of birds, could tell by a minute change in her complexion whether she was going to like her companion or not. "Besotted I may be," he said aloud, "but that spontaneous confidentiality." He didn't finish even the thought, because at a corner immediately ahead appeared the leader of a mule train, an aged animal with a hat on her head, accompanied by a man who, in an enormous roaring voice that echoed in the chasm, desired Stephen and his mare to step aside into the appointed nook. Isabel, the mare, knew exactly what to do, which was just as well, since Stephen was so deep in his own discourse, so intent on his wonderfully convincing, though distant, illusion, he hadn't noticed for the last quarter of a mile that they had been walking on the edge of a sheer, a truly appalling precipice, the road having been cut across the face of a cliff. "Go with God," called the man at the head of the train as he passed. And those at the end blessed Stephen too, comforting in so very lonely and inhuman a spot. But when they were round the corner and plodding steadily upwards in the fading light through the now much narrower valley, his illusion, always a perfectly silent illusion, was no longer there. No searching, no effort of the imagination could call it up. What's more, the nature of the landscape had changed. One more sharp turn, and directly before them, there was the dip in the skyline that showed the high pass, and well below it, on a smooth, almost domestic slope, the lanterns of their inn. A frosty morning, and they crossed the pass, coming to a much more populated road, somewhat tedious and commonplace. Another inn with even poorer food. Up and down, and down. No illusions, alas. But towards the end of a weary day, Santiago. Isabel, rubbed down and filled with a fine warm mash, could go to sleep in her accustomed stable, her head drooping. And Stephen returned to his hotel, where he found Jacob in an unusual state of agitation. "So you've come back," he cried. "I couldn't agree more," said Stephen. "Pray help me off with these boots." The boots off, with a final gasping heave, Jacob said, "Unless these two new agents lie in their teeth, and I could swear they are independent, each ignorant of the other's inquiries, there is anxious news from both Lima and Callao. The Viceroy has decided on invasion, to be preceded with the full consent and approval of the naval staff by an attack on Valparaiso." Stephen nodded, and Jacob went on, "But this, above all the naval part, requires more stores than they possess. And the people concerned, the various boards, are running up and down by rope, canvas, gunpowder, and so on. Fortunately for us, many of those involved, the manufacturers of rope, canvas, and gunpowder, have either, as you may well imagine, raised their prices, or concealed their wares until the prices shall have reached to what they suppose their limit. Can such things be? Asked Stephen. But in any case, before sending off post-haste to warn poor Captain Aubrey, I must be fed. I smelt the homely scent of an olla podrida as I came up the stairs. I've eaten my fill of fried guinea pigs between here and Valparaiso and back again, and I tell you most solemnly that I absolutely must be fed. Well, if your god is your belly, I suppose you must worship it, said Jacob. But he did touch the bell. Within moments, the fragrant olla, which stood perpetually simmering, perpetually renewed, on the rim of the kitchen hearth, reached the eager table. Repletion came at last, and Stephen pushed back his chair. From an inner pocket he drew the pouch in which he kept his coca leaves, the lime, and the necessary outer wrapping. He had no particular urge to chew coca at this moment, but he knew how a meal as substantial as that which he had just eaten dulled the mind. He desired that his wits should be as sharp as possible. And while he carefully dosed his proportions, he said to his friend, Amos, when you used coca in considerable quantities, did you observe a difference in reaction according to altitude? I know that porters in the Peruvian Andes, when they have to carry a heavy burden over a very high pass, will increase the dose to a surprising degree. They seem to take no harm, and I suppose that physical energy, physical endurance, and freedom from hunger was all they sought and all they derived. But have any other effects come to your attention? Not in the north. No, apart from compulsive habituation, of course. But, as you know, there are many sorts of coca. Down here they use the Tijuana. And here, in the case of asthmatic patients or those afflicted with migraine, there have been reports of hallucinations, their strength and frequency varying with the height, not with exertion, but with altitude. Stephen separated the ingredients of his little packet into their different compartments, said, Thank you, dear colleague, but I don't like the notion of a vegetable providing my beatific vision. If it chooses to sharpen my intelligence, to allow me to multiply 7 by 12, well and good. But the sacred emotions, no. Amos, we must go down to Valparaiso directly, though I quite dread seeing that road again. If only you could overcome your prejudice against the mules. As I have said many times before, I could show you a quicker, easier road. True, there are a few very steep passages that only a goat or a mule could venture upon without dread, but you can always leap down after they've shown you the way. Then let us call for excellent mules, with an equivalent number of muzzles and a warranted muleteer. It so happened that Stephen was on a particularly kind and amenable mule, whose goodwill he increased with a piece of bread at each halt. But even she grew excited and inclined to caper as they came down into Valparaiso. The place was filled with soldiers, and the cries and acclamations very soon made it evident that Bernardo O'Higgins, the supreme director, was in the town with his powerful escort of picked troops, many of whom had been at the decisive battle. They led their mules and the muleteer to their hotel by back ways, and there they met a profoundly discontented Killick, who snatched their baggage from the muleteer with a suspicious look and told them that the damn place was crammed with bloody soldier officers and that he'd only kept the doctor's room by force while the poor captain had had to give up his drawing room to an effing colonel on the grounds that the effing colonel spoke English. Which surprise was in the port, admired by all hands, and Captain Aubrey had taken General O'Higgins across the bay in Ringle, and if they survived, they were all going to have dinner aboard Surprise tomorrow, gents. The word tomorrow sent such a gust of impatience racing through Stephen's mind that he missed some of Killick's later information. But later the more phlegmatic, less concerned Jacob passed it on. Lindsay was at sea, protecting Republican trade from privateers, and about 400 of the troops ships were going on to Concepcion, which should make Valparaiso less hoarse and crowded and noisy. The people of the hotel were making up a bed in Stephen's little room, and Killick was angrily trying to put clothes away in inadequate cupboards when the door opened. Stephen looked in, thought that anything would be better than this, and retired. Almost at once, he met an officer who stopped, bowed, and said,
"Dr. Materini Domanova, I presume? Allow me to present myself, Valdez. I used sometimes to come to Ullastret to hunt the boar, and I believe we may call kin."
"Why, you must be the cousin Eduardo, of whose English my godfather was so proud, so rightly proud. I'm delighted to see you,
and I to see you, cousin Stephen."
They embraced, and Stephen suggested that they should go down into the patio and drink to their better acquaintance under the vine. In the daylight, Stephen saw that his new cousin was a colonel, and one who had obviously seen a good deal of service. A soldier, but a thoroughly civilized soldier, who was now speaking of Jack Aubrey in terms of the highest, almost enthusiastic praise. "Such a fine fellow. Don Bernardo took to him at once, and at this moment they are tearing about the bay in a schooner." "Well done, cousin. It was long, long before I learned to call it, to call her, a schooner."
"Ha ha," said the colonel with evident satisfaction. "But tell me, I beg, how does one say director supremo in English?"
"There you have me," said Stephen. "Director general smells of commerce and protector of that villain Cromwell. Perhaps head of state?" They exchanged alternatives, but neither was satisfied by the time Jack and the supreme director himself came in. A fine-looking man, obviously of Irish extraction, followed by several officers. He and Stephen were old friends, and the conversation carried on, still in English. After the first civilities, immense delight in Ringle's sailing qualities on O'Higgins' part, compliments on the Chilean soldier's past deeds and present civility on Stephen's, the conversation continued, and Stephen said, "Sir, I've just come down from Santiago on a mule."
"On a mule, sir?"
"On the quick but perilous road, or rather path, through La Selva, because I had some information that I thought should be conveyed to you with the utmost rapidity." O'Higgins studied his face, looked round the patio, and said, "Let us walk on the battlements. Please come with us, Captain Aubrey, and you too, Colonel. But first be so good as to place sentries to ensure the privacy of our conversation." From the high battlements they could see Surprise and the schooner looking quite beautiful, excellently lit by a declining sun. Surprise being titivated to a truly remarkable extent, for the Supreme Director was to dine aboard her tomorrow. They paced along four abreast, and Stephen told the essence of his news. The Peruvian viceroy's decision to invade, crossing the frontier with horse and foot, once the Peruvian navy had destroyed the Chilean men of war in Valparaiso, the embarrassment of Lima and Callao where stores were concerned, the strong probability that they would seek them in Valdivia.
"Thank you very much indeed, Doctor," said O'Higgins. "This thoroughly confirms the less reliable, less precise intelligence that has reached me."
"Sir," said Jack Aubrey, "may I suggest an immediate reconnaissance? The wind serves admirably, and in all likelihood it'll bring us back. I have rarely seen a more promising breeze."
"Dr. Maturin," said O'Higgins, "did your informant speak of the Peruvian Navy's state of preparedness?"
"Not directly, sir," said Stephen, "but by implication, and by the already soaring prices, it's clear that their only heavy frigate, the Esmeralda, of, I think, 40 guns, is by no means ready to take the sea. As for the smaller craft, I gather that they are even more dilapidated." The Supreme Director considered and said, "If I know anything of those people in Lima, they will be circulating minutes and memoranda from ministry to ministry for at least 10 more days. We have the time. Dear Captain Aubrey, If I may, I will come aboard you to dine, as you so kindly suggested. And while we are eating, let the ship move gently, almost imperceptibly, round the southern headland, and then sail with all diligence for Valdivia to come off the port rather before sunset, so that we may look into it with a light behind us. I shall bring what we have in the way of charts, drawings, and plans. Very good, sir, said Jack, unable to conceal his satisfaction. It was a curious dinner, much commented upon. As far as the ship's crew were concerned, it started naturally enough before dinner, with the ship and all her people being brought to an even more unnatural state of cleanliness and, where possible, of polish. It was natural, too, that the great man's approach should be marked by a roaring of guns that didn't leave a single bird on the water, and that the side should be dressed as he was piped aboard. But even at that early point, there was something odd in his being brought out by the captain's barge, together with a colonel, who made a proper soldier's job of coming aboard. And it was odder still when, well on into the cabin's dinner, the order came to get the barge aboard and start antitivating the ship, stowing the beautifully ornamented man ropes and getting everything back into sea-going order. "I'll tell you what, Maggie," said Poll, skipping to her particular friend. "I think there's something fishy going on. The minute I saw Joe Edwards and his mates unpicking those man ropes with the gentlemen still at table, nowhere near their port even, I smelt a rat." To keep so very complex an entity as a man-of-war functional, all hands and most of the gear must be able to face a great number of widely differing events, circumstances, emergencies, very quickly indeed. And in a man-of-war so highly worked up as the Surprise, with a crew of right seamen, this could usually be done smoothly. But virtually all seaborne emergencies have a certain pattern, a sequence, however disagreeable. And once that pattern is very grievously upset, confidence dwindles. The unpicking of those man ropes did much more harm than the raising of the barge to its usual place on deck. In itself, most unusual, reprehensible, but not downright insane, or even worse, unlucky. As Jack's dinner carried on with its agreeable progress, the decanters making their steady round, most of the frigate's people spoke of their uneasiness, usually confiding in their tie mates, the friends to whom they would entrust their pigtails for combing and replatting, but sometimes to others, quite far removed, even by watch, with whom they had a particular sympathy. These friendships were by no means uncommon, but few were as improbable or as wholly unequal as that which had sprung up between Horatio Hanson and Awkward Davies. Awkward not because of his uncouth motions, but because of his truly awful rage if crossed. They were working together on a new log line and a new sounding line, placing the marks with the extreme accuracy required for exact navigation. "Sir," asked Davies in a low and anxious tone, "did you ever see a man rope stowed, unpicked and stowed when guests were still aboard?" They were certainly still aboard. Their voices eagerly discussing the politics of hunters could be heard quite clearly where the new log line lay. "Oh, as for that," said Horatio, "Paul mentioned it when I went below for a flannel rag, and I told her to be easy. It was the captain's orders."
"Ah, the captain's orders," said Davies, and he sighed with relief.
Shortly after this, the captain's orders came on deck again in the form of a rather small, still immaculately neat midshipman called Wells, who smiled nervously at Hanson and said, "The captain sends me with orders for Mr. Summers. We're to weigh."
"You'll find him in the head," said Hanson.
Very shortly the word came aft and reassurances with it. They were to prepare for weighing. They were to drift with the ebb, and then spread the close-reefed forecourse until they were round the headland. The ship was filled with intense activity, but a calm and relatively placid activity. They knew where they were now. Surprise was to steal away on the ebb according to the captain's long-considered plan, steal away with the lowering sun in the casual watcher's eye, And then, once round the headland, make sail and bear away on this fine easterly offshore breeze in whatever direction he desired, carrying the country's ruler and his mate. With great zeal, but with even greater discretion, they weighed the best bower and the kedge, taking great care that there should be no clashing as the anchor was catted and fished, yet finding time to watch Wingle's boat come across for Mr. Reed, who hooked himself rapidly down the frigate's side without the least ceremony, urged his men to a frenzy of activity, and instantly set about getting the schooner into a similar state of discreet motion. Night. And this being the dark of the moon, an actual instant brilliance of stars. But neither O'Higgins nor Cousin Eduardo was the least degree concerned with astronomy or navigation, and both, as hardened guerrilleros, knew the value of sleep. They smoked a cigar apiece on the quarterdeck, tossed the still glowing stubs into the spectacular wake, and went straight to bed, leaving Jack Aubrey to show Daniel, Hansen, and Shepherd, a midshipman whose intelligence was beginning to develop, the moons of Jupiter. Not indeed as objects of beauty or curiosity, but as valuable elements in fine navigation. The next morning, at a particularly cheerful breakfast, O'Higgins begged Jack to keep well out to sea when they were at the height of Concepcion. "My dear sir," said Jack, "that is not likely to be much before 5 in the afternoon. "Indeed? Yet I thought you'd been driving along at a furious pace, but then I know very little of the sea." "Well, we did manage a little more than 10 knots. We could have made more sail, but I understood that you wished us to come off Valdivia in the last hour or so of the sun." "So I did, of course, and no doubt you apportioned it out." "So I have. Nothing whatsoever is sure at sea, nothing at all. But the barometer's steady, the breeze has every appearance of remaining true, and if we don't see Valdivia before the sun has set, I'll give 10 guineas to any church or charity you choose to name." "Come, that is encouraging," said O'Higgins with an eager smile, "and I will do the same if you succeed." This, very soon, and by the usual channel, became known throughout the ship. Although there was scarcely a man aboard who hadn't left Gibraltar heavy with gold, several years' pay at the least, most had used their not inconsiderable ingenuity to get rid of it. True, some had made really important allocations home, but in any case the ship's company's old sense of values had revived. And when they heard the 10 guineas were at stake, they kept a barky at it with the same zeal that they showed when there was a chase in sight. The officers and reefers were also very busy, but there was scarcely one but Harding, who was such a good seaman as the older hands, and no one who knew the barky better. All orders were anticipated, and when, at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Stephen and Jacob made their perfunctory rounds, two of the usual hernias that would yield only to rest and a couple of obstinate poxes, and drank their habitual cup of tea with Paul and Maggie, they heard Captain Aubrey's very powerful voice telling the Supreme Director down there on the quarterdeck that the blur of smoke 1 point on the starboard quarter was Concepcion. "I am heartily glad of it," replied O'Higgins, directing his voice upwards with all the force he could manage, "and I hope all my people have settled in comfortably." Jack Aubrey had always meant to take in topgallants and even topsails well before standing in for Valdivia, at about the time Cape Corcovado bore due east. But the favourable wind, the current, and above all the people's zeal, showed him the Cape on the larboard bow long before it had any right to be there, long before the sun was low as he could wish. He shortened sail, and when everything was neat, quiet, and properly coiled down, he said to the Supreme Director, "Sir, it occurs to me that you and Colonel Valdez might like to practice climbing into the top in preparation for our closer view of Valdivia a little later when the sun is nearer the horizon." "I should be very happy," said O'Higgins, and Colonel Valdez could hardly say less, but they concealed their happiness quite remarkably as they climbed up and up with a wooden stoicism until they reached the modest height of the main top. "We can go much farther up, you know," said Captain Aubrey. "Thank you. I can see perfectly well from here," said O'Higgins rather shortly, and Colonel Valdez asked whether telescopes might be sent up. In the case of those unaccustomed to going aloft, there was the danger of an involuntary, purely muscular trembling of the hands if one were required to go up and down repeatedly. He was perfectly ready to stay in the top until the true reconnaissance should begin. It couldn't be long now. He could already make out several familiar stretches of the shoreline, and the sun was no great way from the horizon. Rather than distress them by remaining in the top, Jack vanished over the seaward side and returned to his cabin, where once again he studied what O'Higgins had brought in the way of charts, views, and town plans of Valdivia. The charts were of consequence only to the seamen, but those of the views that could be rolled up he tucked into his bosom, and a fairly large panorama could be carried on deck by hand. There he saw Daniel and Hansen taking the bearings of many a peak. Hansen by this time was one of the nimblest topmen in the ship, and Jack said to him, "Mr. Hansen, be so good as to sling this over your back and deliver it to the gentleman in the top. If you take the windward shrouds, I'll take the leeward." At present, O'Higgins and Valdez were a good deal easier in their minds, and since this was country they both knew quite well, they pointed out many of the small villages and churches along the shore. "It will not be long now," said the director, looking eagerly southwards. Nor was it. One small cape, another, and there was the half-ring of fortifications guarding the port of Valdivia. The whole of it, and the more distant town brilliantly lit by the lowering sun. Jack called down a low order, and a backed forecourse reduced the ship's way quite remarkably. The two Chileans searched port and town with their telescopes. A port empty but for some smacks and a trading brig. Moderate activity on the far side of the fortification. The Director General and Colonel Valdez had seen a great deal of fighting, conventional and otherwise. And when Valdez named 250 men as the force he thought adequate for taking the place, Jack believed him. Though it seemed trifling for such an expanse of solid masonry and embrasures for so many guns on the massive dark walls. "Sir," said O'Higgins, turning towards him, "may I ask your opinion? I dare say you have had more experience of attacking fortified ports than we." "Well, sir," said Jack, "the seaward approach is obviously quite different from the way soldiers might envisage the affair on land. I've been looking at that important fortress, the outermost part of the defensive chain, with some people walking about in front of it. It occurs to me that if its defenders are not uncommonly seasoned and courageous, the place ought to be taken by a two-sided attack. And if that fort were taken, the two arcs of the semicircle would find it extremely difficult to cooperate, to mount a counter-attack. Look at the slope of the shore." They discussed this for some little while, the Chileans, who knew the quality of the troops in Valdivia, clearly coming round to Jack's view of the matter. "Very well," said O'Higgins in his decisive way. "I shall beg Captain Aubrey to carry us back to Concepcion as quickly as possible. Could the ship hold 250 men?" he asked, turning to Jack. "Not in any comfort, sir. But if this beautiful wind lasts, and I think it will, they'll not have to suffer long. And there's always the Ringle to take a score or so. Furthermore, I may add that I can contribute at least 100 thoroughly experienced, able seamen, accustomed to the naval side of the attack I have in mind." "That would indeed be a very welcome contribution. Most gratefully accepted." "Very handsome, upon my word," said Valdez. "Now," went on O'Higgins, "if we can but get down on deck in safety, and if the ship can slip quietly away towards Concepcion, I should be most obliged if you would give us your general notion of a combined plan of attack by sea and land." "Very good, sir. I think that the actual descent, Colonel Valdez should take precedence." And raising his voice to its usual pitch, "Pass the word for my coxswain and Davies." Then, some seconds later, lay aloft there, and guide the gentleman's feet. Now, Colonel, this is the lubber's hole, and if you lower yourself through it, powerful hands will guide your feet to the horizontal cords that act as steps. Valdez made no audible reply, but he bowed and very cautiously let himself halfway down. "Handsomely, now, handsomely," called Jack. And the look of extreme anxiety faded from the Colonel's face as competent hands seized his ankles and set his feet on the ratlins. "Now, Excellency, it's your turn," said Jack. "And may I suggest that when you've rested and looked at the charts again, we should sup and then discuss the possibilities?" "Very happy," replied O'Higgins, with a face even graver, more concerned than the Colonel's. However, they were both cheerful, seriously cheerful, when the supper table was cleared and they sat with charts and views spread out before them, and coffee at their sides with brandy for those that liked it. "Now, sir," said Jack, "since you've asked me to begin, I shall start by saying that the gunner and I have overhauled his stores and that materially the scheme that I shall propose is feasible. In essence, it's this. Having embarked your men at Concepcion, they will be men picked for courage, agility and freedom from seasickness, we, the schooner and the frigate, will return a little before dawn, landing all the soldiers and the seamen accustomed to mining, blowing up and destroying gun emplacements, at this point, Cala Alta. The boats will return to the ship, which will then make sail and proceed to a station off the fort, which she will most deliberately bombard from ranges suited to the accuracy of the defenders. But at no time will she fire on the great gate leading to the mole. During this bombardment, the soldiers and seamen will advance along the path on the inland side, and I think the intensity and the noise of the bombardment will prevent the defenders, the comparatively unseasoned and inexperienced defenders, as Colonel Valdez tells me, from noticing their approach. But whether or no, the seamen's task is to fire rockets and stink pots into all embrasures, filling the whole place with vile, unbreathable fumes and stench, and to mine all emplacements with guns in them. All this time, the soldiers will keep up a steady fire, shrieking and bawling like fiends." "What is fiends?" whispered Valdez in Stephen's ear. "Demonios." Then followed a whispered Spanish conversation in which Valdez described a pillar in a cathedral of his childhood, which showed devils tormenting the damned in hell, uttering shrieks as they did so. When this was over, Stephen's closer attention returned to Jack Aubrey's discourse. "And my reason for leaving the northern wall and its gatehouse untouched is that I'm convinced that the defenders, unless they're hardened grenadiers, will very quickly sicken of the bombardment and the sulphurous fumes and stench, and seek to escape by rushing out of the gate and running along the mole to the next strong point, or the one beyond, if not to the town itself, or at least to the storehouses. And as they flee, we can pepper them with grape and then pursue..." He paused. The Chileans looked at one another, and O'Higgins, sure of the reply, said, "Colonel, may we hear your opinion?"
"Excellence," said Valdez, "it seems to me an eminently feasible operation."
"I entirely agree. Dear Captain Aubrey, may I beg you to desire your people to sail the ship back to Concepcion as rapidly as may be convenient?"
"By all means, sir. But as I believe you noticed, we altered the frigate's appearance. Remarkable to any seaman. And to return to Concepcion with any speed, we must restore her mainmast. The one in the middle," he added.
"Certainly the central mast. Can it indeed be changed at sea?"
"With a strong crew and a moderate sea, yes, but it takes time, and you might think it prudent to send your orders into Concepcion by the schooner. She'll get there much sooner, and when we arrive, if all goes well, your men should be waiting on the quay."
"That shall be written at once, in emphatic words suited to the meanest intelligence. And, as I recall, the men are to be picked for courage, agility, and freedom from seasickness."
"Exactly so, sir.
And as soon as they're written, I shall entrust them to Mr. Reed, who commands the schooner, with orders to proceed to Concepcion without the loss of a minute, there to embark the troops named in the margin, and to return with the utmost dispatch. And as soon as he's underway, it may interest you to see a brutish, stump-masted, unmemorable frigate transformed into something truly glorious by the towering mainmast, a 36-gun ship. And then when all is a-tanto and belayed, we shall set out with a press of sail for Concepcion. Out and back again. Still on this glorious and even strengthening west wind, a splendid piece of sailing. So splendid that it reconciled the sombre infantrymen crammed into the two vessels, so that at times they burst into song. They had a likeable, fairly intelligent set of officers to whom the largest plan of Valdivia had been shown, spread out in the gunroom, while the fairly simple plan of attack was explained again and again. Two of the officers knew Valdivia well, and they pointed out the storehouses at the end of the mole with the treasury behind them. A little before dawn, with Mars rising astern, the galleys in both crafts were heated to something not far from incandescence, and the cooks and their mates served out a royal breakfast to all hands, not a crock, nor a pot, nor a square wooden plate being left unfilled. By now, the mountains were filling a quarter of the sky. A few scattered lights could be seen ashore, and Surprises and Ringle's officers were very busy in getting their boats over the side, formed into two trains, ready to be manned. Jack, right forward with his night glass, saw the Cala Alta clear and the central fortification looming up behind it. He had already reduced sail. The ship's people were extraordinarily silent, almost the only sound coming from the breeze, much less inshore, whispering through the rigging and from the water running gently down the side. With the Cala Alta close on the larboard bow, Jack called, "Let go!" And a kedge was lowered into the sea, bringing the ship up just abreast of the rock. The boats put off one by one, five dark lanterns in each. The seamen ran them beyond the tide mark. The silent lines formed up, glimmering light between each band. Harding, in charge of the detachment of heavily laden seamen, said, "Give way!" And they stepped out, followed by the soldiers. "Kedge," called Jack, "hands to the braces." The frigate's yards came round. Her sheeted sails took the wind, and she moved forward faster, faster. And the main fortress came abreast of the larboard beam, lightless, blind except for a single window. He glanced aft. No sign of the marching column yet. "Mr. Beaton," he called to the gunner, "what do you make it?"
"A trifle above 500 yards, sir."
"Try a sighter mid-high."
"Aye, aye, sir. Mid-high it is."
And the gunner's voice was cut off by the bellow of his gun and the shriek of the recoiling carriage. The wind swept the smoke forward and all eyes strained to see the impact. Nothing could the most eager make out in the darkness, but almost at once the windows came to life, row after row of lamp-lit squares. "Fire as they bear," said Jack, still in little more than an undertone, and louder. "A rolling fire there." This was not a time for broadsides, nor yet for the regular fore-to-aft of target practice. "I don't wish to strain the ship's timbers," he said in a much louder voice to the Chileans behind him, and louder still, "Vast firing! Mr. Wells," to his attendant midshipman, "tell the officers commanding the guns that I'm going to move up 100 yards or so." By this time the fort was replying, with a crackle of musketry and the odd bullet passed overhead. "Mr. Daniel," he called, "move her up, if you please, until we can see the gatehouse and the mole. Then to the gun crews, fire at will." Now there were as many as three great flashes, hungry darts of flame at once lighting the wall, and it was clear that the fire was having its effect. Two windows beaten into one. Fallen masonry, A small blaze inside a room, the whole outer wall pockmarked. The lit windows began to move aft, the guns still firing briskly, but they'd not gone beyond Surprise's mizzenmast before a violent explosion shook the back of the fortress, followed by musket fire, and then three more explosions even deeper. The gatehouse came in sight, well in sight, and now the Surprise, swinging slightly to larboard, could send a crossfire into the shattered centre. This she did, while on the far side, the mining and the musketry increased until the noise reverberating from the mountains behind the town was perfectly shocking. "One would say a heavy artillery battle," said Colonel Valdez. "Mr. Wells," called Jack, "run and tell them not to touch that goddamn gatehouse." Now the musketry from the fort diminished and the mining increased. "It is unbelievable that they should have carried all that powder," observed Stephen. "Any minute now," said Jack. "Mr. Daniel, lay me for the mole just abaft those two smacks the instant that door opens, and stand by to make her fast. Mr. Summers, Mr. Summers there, let the armourer and his mates serve out cutlasses, pistols, boarding axes." A great roar all along the deck drowned his last words. The gatehouse doors burst open, and a dense crowd of men rushed out, trampling one another and racing along the mole. "Reload with grape," called Jack. And they had half a dozen rounds before the ship ground against the dolphin of the mole. "Starboard watch, make fast fore and aft. Larboard, charge!" By this time the soldiers behind the fort had seen the flying garrison on the mole, and they joined the pursuers. The seamen flung down their heavy crowbars and sledgehammers and caught up with wonderful speed. "Surely," gasped Stephen as he ran, "it is very strange that the zeal of the pursuers should be greater than that of the prey." Strange or not, it was true. The fugitives had no sooner reached the next fort than those who were not killed had to run again, often being caught and knocked down. And so it went, fort after fort, until the miserable remnant ran clean away up into the town, leaving the entire port and all its naval equipment to the victor's discretion. In this case, the victors showed no discretion whatsoever. Some of the Chilean soldiers knew the port well, having worked there, and they showed their allies a perfectly extraordinary treasure of rope, sailcloth, blocks, firearms great and small, timber, powder, ammunition, medicine chests, and, what pleased them even more, the treasury. It had armoured doors, of course, but the seamen, running back for some of their heavier tools, made short work of armoured doors or the pillars that supported them. Inside, there were four large chests of silver and a moderate chest of gold. Curiously enough, they were only closed with a hasp. And on seeing their contents, a soldier who'd been in the Surprise said they'd all risked their lives to gain this wealth, and that in his opinion it should be shared out equally at once. Now, equally and at once. His opinion was supported by several men there, but O'Higgins said, "A fig for your opinion," and shot him dead. With so much death in the forts, all along the mole and in the lesser fortifications, this made no great impression. But it did restore order. And when Captain Aubrey suggested to the Supreme Director that the right and natural place for all these things was Valparaiso, to be conveyed in the Surprise as far as the chests were concerned, while the huge accumulation of marine stores lying outside the magazines, lofts and victualling buildings should travel in the two large smacks lying just beyond the frigate, outside the mole. Once the treasure chests had been moved across the yard on rollers, cut from new topmasts, to the Surprise, and taken aboard by those ingenious cranes improvised by seamen, zeal began to flag. People, particularly soldiers, looked at the massive cables with distaste and showed a disposition to creep away. Stephen, however, asked Jack to have the head of a barrel containing Chilean aguardiente taken off for Dr. Jacob. And he called upon all hands in both necessary languages to form in lines and to advance in turn. This they did, and each man passing Jacob was given a cup from the barrel. Then, moving on to Stephen, he received a very considerable dose of prime coca with its usual accompaniments. Within a remarkably short space of time, so long as time in the ordinary sense still existed in their circumstances and their very recent, very violent past, the atmosphere changed entirely. Strength returned and good humour with it. The daunting heaps lessened, dwindled, vanished entirely into the smacks amicably chartered with the help of the golden chest, and the cobbles lay bare under the indifferent moon. "Cousin," said Colonel Valdez, embracing him, and they, standing alone in the five-acre yard, "that was a glorious victory, a most glorious victory." Interchapter. "My dear Christine, if you will allow so free an expression," wrote Stephen Matchlin, "we won a famous victory in Valdivia not long since, when Captain Aubrey and his seamen, with General O'Higgins and his soldiers, having destroyed the main fortress, drove the Royalists out of Valdivia, secured their immense stock of naval stores and their treasure, returning in triumph to Valparaiso to rejoicing, cheering crowds, to fireworks and music, three separate bullfights and, of course, to dancing. None of our people was killed. Their few wounds are healing well, and all hands are charmingly elated, at least in part because of their coming wealth, when the prize money from the captured treasure is shared out. I, too, was elated with them. Happiness is charmingly contagious, and I celebrated the occasion by indulging myself in an emerald. As you may know, my valued friend and colleague Amos Jacob is descended from a family of merchants dealing in precious stones. He understands and loves them. And, like many of his calling, he has acquaintances or connections in Golconda and other places where gems are found, including Muso in the Andes, no very great way from here, so justly renowned for its emeralds. I therefore desired him to procure me a specimen. And here it is." He turned the oblong stone in his hand. "A splendid wealth of green, but finest of all from its perfect face. I shall wrap it in jeweller's cotton wool, enclose it in a packet for Sir Joseph that must leave this evening, and beg you to accept it as a small token of my esteem, a trifling return for Ardeo Goliath." Here he paused, shook his head, and walked up and down the room, glancing at his watch. Up and down. It was most unlike Jack Aubrey to be late. And although the Indian runner didn't mean to set out much before dawn, he was uneasy. He sat down again, returning to his letter. "But now, my dear, I grieve to say that our joy has diminished to something not very far from grief. The triumph at Valdivia, after the first explosion of popular joy, gave way to a singular but ever-increasing jealousy and resentment. It was the victory of what is seen as the English and of O'Higgins, the one the hereditary enemy of Spaniards, and Republicans or Royalists, the mass of Chileans, are essentially Spanish, either as buccaneers or raiders like Drake and national enemies in times of war, and the other disliked, even hated, by many of the leading men in the various juntas for curbing their pretensions, for his love of law and order, and for his opposition to a dominant church. To some degree, this growing resentment unites the juntas, but just to what extent, I don't know, because Jacob is away gathering information. Yet it is a fact that the treasure we captured has not been shared out, the seamen have not been paid, and that for some days past I, for one, have met with open rudeness in the streets of Valparaiso. O'Higgins, his personal friends and guard, have retired to Santiago, or perhaps beyond, and we have no news. What is more, and perhaps worse, is that Sir David Lindsay, resenting an incivility, has been challenged by one of his own officers. They are now on the ground." "I'm losing my wits entirely," he murmured to himself. drawing a careful line round those parts of his letter that were suitable only for Sir Joseph and in encoded form. The line was not finished before he heard a step, a knock, and he called out, "Come in." It was Hanson.
"Oh, sir,"
he cried, much upset. "He was hit. The captain sent me. The surgeon said there was no hope." There was indeed no hope. "Aorta," said the Chilean medical man, motioning towards the great dark pool under Lindsay's body.
"No hope?"
asked Jack. And when Stephen shook his head, "Mr. Hanson, double up to the ship again and tell Mr. Harding that I should like 4 stout hands and a stretcher to carry Sir David's body down, and a sheet to cover him. To Stephen, we shall bury him navy fashion, the way he's used to." This caused a movement of uneasiness among Lindsay's remaining Chilean friends. His opponent and the seconds, apart from Jack, had disappeared. And one of them said to Stephen, "The prefect of the port will have to view the body and approve the burial."
"It is the custom,"
said Stephen with grave emphasis. "The ancient naval custom." The word had such force for the Spaniards that their murmuring ceased. They stayed until the stretcher came up from the port. And then, when Lindsay was laid on it and covered, the military men and sailors saluted as he was carried away, while the few civilians took off their hats. Though one standing next to Stephen murmured that this would no doubt offend the prefect extremely. Jack told Harding to slip his moorings and to take the ship to 20-fathom water outside the mole. There, when he'd taken everything that should go to Lindsay's family, he called for the sailmaker and 2 round shot. And when Lindsay was shrouded navy fashion, Jack buried him before the assembled crew with the full ceremony and honours due to his former rank, saying the ritual words as he went over the side. Then the surprise, doing away with the formal signs of mourning, returned to the harbour, returned to her former place. "In almost any breeze this allows me to get out to sea," he said privately to Stephen. "I've already seen enough to make me uneasy, and I have no doubt you've seen much more."
"Yes," said Stephen, "and I'm only waiting for Jacob to come back with fuller information about the southern hunters, to know whether I should officially advise you to withdraw from the political enterprise entirely and devote yourself to pure hydrography or not. The Chonas Archipelago is virtually unknown."
"And who knows what unknown wonders its flora and fauna may reveal," he added inwardly. They were in the cabin drinking tea, and after a long silence, Jack said, "Stephen, what I'm going to say will probably sound sentimental to you, but several of those young fellows I've been training show every sign of becoming first-rate seamen. And for this reason, among a host of others, I have been turning a plan over and over in my head. As you know, it was only the treasure of Valdivia that, like a fool, I handed over to the authorities. The naval stores we turned to our own uses as far as our needs went. And the Barkey is now almost entirely new-rigged, stuffed with powder and shot, worn cables replaced, sailcloth to clothe the ship of the line, prime victuals overflowing. So my plan is to attack Callao and to cut out Esmeralda. I put it to Lindsay, but he said it was impossible. The fortresses would sink us before ever we came to grips, and coming to grips with a massively built 50-gun frigate was no task for 28-gun surprise, even supported by the Asp. He was fundamentally opposed to the plan, called it foolhardy, which surprised me, knowing how many times he'd been out. But I shall say no more about him, poor soul. God rest him. No more. So that, Stephen, is what I mean to do. Do you like my plan?"
"My dear,
I am tolerably good at carrying out a suprapubic cystotomy. You are an expert in maritime warfare. Your opinion in the first case would not be worth a straw, nor would mine in the second. If you are content, I am content. Nevertheless, Captain Aubrey went on arguing his case. It was true that Peru was a neutral state, a Spanish colony, but Peru had repeatedly invaded the independent Republic of Chile, and if the Spanish viceroy succeeded next time, the infant Chilean navy, so promising and zealous, would be wiped out. There was everything to be said for... Beg pardon, sir, said a midshipman, but with Mr. Summers' duty, the Lisbon packet is rounding the Cape with someone very like Dr. Jacob waving a red handkerchief in the bows. Thank you, Mr. Glover. Pray tell him that I should like a signal thrown out inviting her to come alongside. Jack went on prosing away about the advantages of surprise, almost certainly superior gunnery and attention to duty, until at last they heard the gentle glancing impact of the packet against the fender, the usual shrieks and cries of those throwing and catching ropes, and Jacob appeared. By God, sir, he cried, addressing Jack, now the fact is in the fire. The burying of poor Sir David, God rest his soul, before an official inquiry, was perfectly illegal and has given the prefect just the excuse he wanted. The ship will be impounded at nightfall. It is known as far down as Villanueva, where the local junta has handed out arms. Has the order to seize the ship been given? I believe so. Jack rang the bell, said, pass the word for Mr. Harding. And to the lieutenant, he said, Mr. Harding, there will be no shore leave whatsoever this evening, and if any boats approach, they are to be denied admission, and I am going aboard the packet. But, sir, cried Jacob, I have been too hasty. First, I should have said that Colonel Valdez is marching his troops back from Concepcion, and messengers have already been sent to the Supreme Director. Even so, said Jack, I shall carry on with my plan. He left them there, went on deck, and dropped down into the packet. Gentlemen, he said to the company of fellows, may I beg for 5 minutes of your time? They all murmured agreement, and Austin Dobson invited him below. Am I right in supposing that you're now heading for Panama?
We are indeed, said Dobson. Sclater and Buick, nodding towards the two ornithologists, are eager to cross the isthmus quite soon, there being the possibility of no less than 3 ships leaving for England in the 3rd week of the month, and they would like a few days with the Terns on the Pacific side.
In that case, dear colleagues, said Jack, you can, if you choose, do me and Matcham an essential service. You're all acquainted, I believe, with the very delicate state of this country and the likelihood of O'Higgins being overthrown and the consequent anarchy and an inevitable Peruvian invasion. They nodded, and an entomologist murmured, those vile juntas. At the moment, it's nip and tuck, or touch and go. But I mean to sail for Callao tonight with the intention of cutting out the Peruvians' 50-gun frigate Esmeralda, of carrying her back to Valparaiso, and of manning her with picked men from the Chilean Navy trained by poor Lindsay and myself. That should put the balance of power more strongly on the Republican side, even before the return of O'Higgins and the troops from Concepcion. Certainly, said an astronomer. But, my dear sir and colleague, we're men of science, not war. Just so, said Captain Aubrey. But as scientists, you're accurate observers. You will very soon make out whether the battle is won or lost. And the first of my 2 requests is that you will send the result, either way, to the Admiralty with the utmost dispatch. And as scientists, you will understand the importance of my second. Our brother, Stephen Maturin, has left all his collections at our inn in Valparaiso. I and this ship have incurred the enmity of the local authorities. I dare not let him go ashore. You, under the aegis of the Royal Society, may do so without fear. You may sup agreeably at the Antigua Sevilla, gather his belongings,
and so joined this ship and her tender, the schooner Ringle, just a mile off the harbour at midnight.